stood there boldly, sweating in the sun. Felt like a million, felt like number one. The height of summer, I'd never felt that strong, like a rock. I was 18, didn't have a care, working for peanuts, not a dime to spare. But I was leaning solid everywhere, like a rock. My hands were steady, my eyes were clear and bright. My walk had purpose, my steps were quick and light. And I held firm to what I felt was right, like a rock. Like a rock.
To talk with George Norrie, call the Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And with the incredible story tonight, Charles Hall, what he witnessed as he documented it in his series of books called Millennial Hospitality Series. And Paula Harris, investigative reporter, she's live in Rome. We'll be back with both of them in a moment on Coast to Coast AM and your phone calls. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with our guest Charles Hall, Paula Harris. Paula, at what point did you believe the story? From the get-go, or did it take a while?
Well, the way I operate, I'm as skeptical as I can be until I actually take the person to the place, or I actually spend a lot of time with the person. I've never done a story where I haven't been with the person for long periods of time. So I think when I actually believed the story is when we flew Charles to Indian Springs, and David Coote and I filmed him as he was telling us, and ironically enough, you had just asked about some kind of accident or if there was a collision. He was telling us about an incident and showed us and walked the path of where he had, you know, how this had happened, and walked over the sagebrush over to a telephone pole and described it, of how there had been an accident where one of the spacecraft had a hole in it and there were children and women aboard, and how they had this relief on their face when they finally did land and so forth. And he told it in detail. That was one incident when we were in Indian Springs. And then the other incident, there is, if you read Millennial Hospitality, at night, they used to go to the home of the teacher with the children, used to go to a home where there was a little human girl that used to come out and play with the alien children at night without her parents knowing about it. She'd come out the window and play with them. And that, to me, sociologically, because I'm interested in the exopolitics of this and the sociological aspect more than the technology of this, was very interesting. I wanted Charles to show me where the house was. I wanted him to tell me all this. And he was able to come through. He was able to actually give us details because we were on the spot.
Why did they bring children here, Charles?
They travel as family groups. You know, they'd do anything for their kids. Their kids would do anything for their parents. The idea of being separated from their children is like, unthinkable for them. Everywhere they go, they're willing to take their kids.
All right, we're going to take phone calls now this hour for you, Paula, and for you, Charles. So let's go right to the phones. Charles, I'm going to ask you to speak up as much as you can because you and Paula are now sharing a phone bank here. Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hello, George and Ray. Happy New Year to you and Paula and Charles. I have two questions, please. One is there were references in old magazine and newspaper articles And apparently the bones of these tall whites are in the basement of the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. And I was wondering, Charles, if you thought those might be the same people? They were found in the Grand Canyon, and Indians talk about these people.
I can only talk from my direct experiences, and I don't have any direct experience that would let me make a statement about the bones.
Okay, so, I understand that.
Yeah,
and I like the friendly title you chose, but also the person who took you was a pilot, and the name was Coot.
Yes.
And I do believe that I know this family.
Do you mean the pilot? The pilot and the family, you mean?
Yes.
So the pilot that works with me, his name is David Coot. He flies for a commercial airlines, and he basically came. I asked him to come on board because I needed someone to do this story who was, a responsible, ethical person who could determine credibility and so forth. So maybe you would know David Coot. He currently flies for a commercial airline.
Well, what does David say about this whole case, Paula?
Well, it'd be interesting for you to interview him. He at first was extremely skeptical. I mean, this is an incredible story, but he spent so much time with Charles, and even on his own has flown down to be with Charles in Albuquerque, that he is convinced that Charles believes he's telling the truth. That's the only way we could put it. Charles believes that all the details he's telling are true, and that this needs to be looked at.
Doesn't Michael Sala believe this, too?
Yes, Michael Sala believes this. Actually, anybody who spent a long time with Charles knows that this is so rich in details. It's so rich in history. I mean, he knows what happened when. He can tell about the various incidents in Indian Springs. He remembers everything about when he was there. Also, his experience in the Vietnam War, that this is a tremendously credible...
Well, Paula, I want you to know David Coot is on the phone now.
Oh.
We're going to get him on right now, okay?
Okay.
I believe this is him. You can tell us if this is him or not, Paula. Hello?
G'day, Paula. How you doing?
David, wonderful. David is from New Zealand. He's got a New Zealand accent. He has also been in the military, so maybe, David, you can talk a little bit about the investigation.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks so much. And, George, thanks for taking my call. And, Charlie, how are you doing?
Hi, David. It's great talking with you and Paula tonight. I want to let you talk.
Sure,
it's
well,
really
thank
great
you both.
Talking with you.
Thank you both for your kind words, and it's definitely my privilege to have an opportunity to be involved in this amazing story.
What did you think about it, David, when you were first brought into it?
Well, I never took UFOs seriously for a very long time, even though a chief pilot of mine had a sighting in a major incident in New Zealand in 78, 79, tracked on radar, lots of ground witnesses, and the U.S. Navy came in and did a big report on it. That was one thing that got my attention. The other thing that got my attention was my history. I was involved in a POW MIA cause for a while, and I came to find out about a gentleman named Colonel Corso who had testified at some Senate hearings on POWs left behind. And so when the book The Day After Roswell came out, I was kind of stunned to find out it was the same gentleman.
The
head of the Foreign Technology Desk and Eisenhower's intelligence officer. So he was credible in my eyes. So all of a sudden the UFO subject became pertinent and prominent. And having found out that, yes, we had left POWs behind, and even in the Vietnam War, we were not told the truth over many of these things, I decided I had to do some probing and find out exactly what else haven't we been told. And so the UFO subject, the more you dig, the more you find, and inevitably you come to this extraterrestrial subject. So I don't see why it's such an amazing thing anymore, because you look out in the universe, it's a huge universe. We are here. Why should they not be here? And in fact, we may even be related. I love to hear this story because Charles' story is not a Hollywood story. This is not something about grizzly or ghouly alien-type creatures that with monsters jumping out of their stomachs and drooling and wanting to eat people. this is about people like you and me that have kids, that love, that live, that have technology that's a little further down the track than ours. But it's an amazing story, and I think it's time for the truth. And this story may be the thing, the crack in the dam, the chink in the armor that brings the truth forth. And, of course, we have to be very wary and very aware that there are different factions and factors to this story. There are those who want disclosure, those who don't, those who perhaps can feel they can use information for their own control purposes and power purposes. But basically, let us judge by their fruits, as the Bible says, and give them the benefit of the doubt until they prove themselves otherwise.
David, do you find yourself watching the skies a little differently now that you believe in this?
You know, I am always trying to be logical in my way of life, and you have to be pragmatic. After all, we have to go to work in the morning, and our child has to try and catch some sleep before he gets to work again. And he's the one that's lived with these extraterrestrials. He's the one that's interacted. He knows the protocol now, and this is a very important lesson for mankind. We need to learn about not only the exopolitical, the protocol, but the exobiology, and even the exotheology. We need to know that we all have one God. It's got to be a unifying process, not a divisive process. And there are those that would like to perhaps divide and conquer. And this is not what we're about. All we're about is the truth. And whether this story is able to be proven or not, all we want is the truth. And it's a very, very hard story to prove because of the highly secure area these things took place in. And we're dealing with a military-industrial complex again once. As Eisenhower warned us to be aware and wary of, and just like von Braun warned us to be wary of, these people need money to keep their industries running. So don't necessarily buy a threat. As Paula said earlier, we don't know what we're seeing in the sky, if it's our technology or extraterrestrial technology. Yes, I look in the skies a lot. I've never had a sighting. Actually, I have to take that back. Earlier this month, I saw something flying up the interstate here that I can't explain. It was a totally bizarre object, and it's very curious. I don't know what it is, but yes, I do watch the skies. George, thanks for asking.
Do most of your pilot colleagues believe, or are they skeptics?
No, I think most pilots are very much mechanically minded, logical. If you can't hold it, it doesn't exist. There is a small slice of the population of pilots that are a little bit more that way inclined, I guess. They are open-minded to it. But generalization, I would say that most pilots pretty much don't spend a lot of time thinking about UFOs and extraterrestrials.
I got to ask you one last question. It's a plane-related question, David. The flight question. Then I'll go back to Charles and Paula and let you go.
I don't want to waste their time.
No,
very
quickly, FAA is going to change the distance between planes from 2,000 feet to 1,000. What do you think about that?
Well, they actually have done that already. The first day they put that into practice was on the 20th of this month, and I was flying that day. I think it's quite okay. The barometric pressures at high altitudes, initially they thought it was going to be a factor as far as separation between the opposing traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've got it down now. We're under radar, and we have GPS, where the accuracy is safe now. And so they wouldn't institute these things until they'd proven that it was going to be safe for the public. And it's wonderful to see a big 747 go by, either below you or above you at 1,000 feet. With your closure rate.
Easy for you to say. All right, thanks, David.
Well, thank you so much, and all the best, guys.
Okay, very good. That was nice of him to call in like that, Paula. And Charles, let's go back to the phones. Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yeah, hi. Where are you calling from, sir?
I am calling from St. Paul, Minnesota.
Sure,
I'm sitting on the historic Summit Avenue in, I guess, the inner city of St. Paul.
Yes,
Minnesota.
You are.
First of all, David was a great help. I think my question ties in a little bit. I was worried that being on hold, I wasn't going to, the point was going to be missed. But Charles, and I'm sorry, the other guest you have, I tuned in late.
Paula Harris is here.
Paula's with us.
Paula.
And Charles.
Paula,
we're good friends, yeah.
Okay, Paula. Charles, earlier you mentioned that the tall whites had a personality of their own. In a way, they were a little bit unpredictable and maybe rebels in their own right. And I was wondering, since you said that they were escorted into Las Vegas, they obviously have an interest in what's going on in this world. Have you ever heard of any of these tall whites, I guess maybe taken off on their own into the world? And not just the tall whites, but maybe any other civilization that might be studying us or interacting with us, that they may actually take off into our culture and try to learn our culture on their own instead of being escorted by us, and especially by their own culture, just like we have rebels in our own culture. They do as well.
They weren't necessarily escorted by humans when they came in. They'd come in with their own guards, and they may or may not come in with humans. One night when I was standing on the corner in downtown Las Vegas, and out in front of the casino known as the Four Queens, when they came in fully escorted, they came in with a group of CIA guards. There were six of them, four men and two women, who first came in, spread wide, and took up positions around the, like a half block down from the intersection. And then the tall white guards came in, disguised as human, and took up their positions. And then the teacher and Pamela came in. And that's when they came in, like, fully escorted. On the other hand, on a different night, I saw just two of the young men, tall white men, walking by themselves down on the strip, heading down towards the Aladdin. And it was common to see them down by the Tropicana as well, just on their own. And some of the casinos, the CIA or the government had human guards who wouldn't necessarily walk around with the tall whites, but would just be like, dealing. They'd be like blackjack dealers and pit bosses. And then they would, in effect, maintain safe casinos. So like the Stardust, sometimes the dealers, or in the casinos down by the Stardust, sometimes when you'd be walking through there, some of the dealers would just be, wouldn't be the usual union dealers. They would be like the government, like the CIA guards or the government guards, who would come in and be just working the tables, with the knowledge of the security people in the casino. So that when the tall whites came through, if there'd always be a few friends around, So like if you were to go up to one of the tall whites and say, start asking too many questions, what you might find is the human guards would come and elbow you out of the way, And of course in history you also have the legend of Saint Germain back, I'm not sure the year, so I don't want to quote it. But remember, Saint Germain was described as having a chalk-white skin, only eating plants. Some people say that he was never seen to eat in public, and seemed to know an awful lot about faraway places.
Well, Charles, let me ask you, do you think we possibly were seeded by these extraterrestrials thousands of years ago? Might they have been the ones to help jumpstart our civilization?
I don't think so, because they...
We're going to have to call you back, Charles, and get a better line. We'll do that with you right now. Paula, what do you think about that question? Might they have seeded us?
Hey, should I hang up?
Well, we got you. Now we have you. Where's Paula?
Then maybe it's Paula. You have to call back.
Maybe it is Paula.
Yeah, because I can hear you fine.
Paula, you there?
Yeah.
There you go. Okay. All right. Well, good. We'll go with that question then, Charles. Very quickly, do you think they seeded us?
I never saw, when I talked with them, I never saw any evidence that would support the statement. So in order for me to say anything, I'd have to guess. I personally don't think they did. I think they just came here. They weren't that interested in controlling us or anything like that. Anytime they did something, it was for their purposes, and they were very happy to be the way they were. And I never personally saw any evidence that they cared, whether we fought with each other or what we did. So from my point of view, I don't believe that anyone treated this up, but, I have to guess.
Well, we're having a bad line with you, so we're going to call you back, and Are you there now, Charles?
No, I'm here now.
Okay, there you are. A little better. You can't share a line with Paula for some reason.
Want me to hang up?
No. You're okay where you are right now. Oh. It's just bad feedback put you on the same line with Paula. So we'll be right back. We'll finish up with more questions. Charles Hall, Paula Harris on Coast to Coast AM.
Get it in writing with the After Dark newsletter. Subscribe by calling 1-888-727-5505.
And people share the gift of gab between themselves. Some are quick to take the bait and catch the perfect prize that waits among the shells. But Oz never did give nothing to the Tin Man that he didn't already have. And cause never was the reason for the evening or the Tropic of Sir Galahad. So please believe in me when I say I'm spinning round, 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 round. Smoke glass stained bright cup, image going down, 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 down. So
Wildcard line at area code 818-501-4109. The first time caller line is area code 818-501-4721. To talk with George toll free from east of the Rockies, call 1-800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll free at 1-800-618-8255. International callers may reach George Norrie by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll free 800-893-0903. From the City of Angels, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
On our next Coast to Coast program, my guest will be John Zaffis. Who is John Zaffis? Well, he's a top paranormal researcher and nephew of Ed and Lorraine Warren, and he'll share the many experiences that he has had over the past 30 years regarding hauntings, near-death experiences, possessions, exorcisms, and so much more. So that'll be on our next Coast to Coast program. The After Dark, it is a CD, 2.5 hours of a double CD of great bumper music, unforgettable calls to the show, and some classic ghost stories. You can order it by going to AfterDarkCD.com. It'll be the only CD that I ever do, so that's the way it is. AfterDarkCD.com or call this toll-free number, 1-800-598-2331. 1-800-598-2331. And welcome back to Coast. It'll be our final segment now with our investigator, Paula Harris, who's live in Rome, and Charles Hall. Charles, how did you get the name Millennial Hospitality Series? How'd that come about?
Well, my wife and I picked it out. When I first explained to my wife, tried to explain to my wife after back in the 1970s, after we'd been married 6 months, you know, about aliens and stuff, she had said that what she cared about was how she should act when if we ever came you know, met one, and you know, that led to kicking in our name, Millennial Hospitality. And let me say, I really appreciate your music. They bring back so many memories. You know? especially that song, Get It On. Boy, it makes me feel young again.
It sure does. Well, in 1965, you were probably pretty young then, too, weren't you?
Yeah, I was still very young. And also, it was common for some of the men who were with me, and myself included on a couple occasions, when you first saw the tall whites, to mistake them for being ghosts. And so I've always felt that if a person looked at some of the so-called ghost stories or haunting stories carefully, that what the person was really seeing, sometimes they would be seeing ghosts, but sometimes they would also be seeing, they would have also just be seeing tall whites. I note that Harry Truman in the late 40s thought the White House was haunted, based, and he claimed that he'd seen the ghost of Abraham Lincoln. But when you go through his story carefully, I myself suspect that really it was the tall whites making contact with Harry Truman, because Harry Truman described the tall white, what he saw, as tall and white, a little bit taller than him. And he said when he went out into the hallway, that the guard in the White House had apparently fallen asleep standing up, or you'll allow me to say the word hypnotized.
Yes.
And so I've always felt that by studying ghost stories, like here in New Mexico, the ghost of Dona Ana County, that what you were really looking at, which goes back to the 1600s, and was observed by the Spanish and the Indians and so on, that what you were really looking at was people who were seeing the tall whites.
Oh, interesting indeed. All right, back to the phones we go. Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, hi. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, this is Steven, mm-hmm. calling from San Diego.
Hi, Steven.
Yeah, I just have a question for your guest.
Go ahead, Steven.
Yeah, okay. Basically, he was saying how they have guns. And I remember on a previous show that you've had that extraterrestrials come down here on Earth to, you know, they're peaceful, you know, they're anti-guns and stuff. So I was just wondering if your guests had an answer for me. Why do they carry guns, you know, along the lines of protecting themselves? Or what is it with that?
What was their main concern? And you can listen on the radio. What was your main concern there, Charles, with them having the guns? Did they not? They didn't trust us, I guess, huh?
If they got angry, they themselves would say, and they never got angry with me, but the men that I talked to who they had been angry with, if they became angry, they would say, do you think we're fools? Do you think we can't protect ourselves? Do you think we come here unarmed? I knew a CIA guard that told me that one day he was escorting the teacher down the steps of the Capitol building, and she was disguised to look like a human, and so she was wearing, had flat heels or low heels. And because they're frailer than we are, they walk somewhat differently than we do. And as they were coming down the steps and he was walking beside her, he wasn't used to the way that they walked down steps.
Mm-hmm.
He was afraid that she was going to fall and hurt herself. And so without thinking, he reached over and grabbed her by the elbow to stabilize her.
Uh-oh, big mistake, huh?
To stabilize her. And he said that she became, you know, their nervous system runs like two or three times faster than
mm-hmm.
And he said she became instantly angry, pulled out the little white pencil microwave device that she carried under her sleeve, and had him down on his knees like a dog, you know, giving him like the electric shock treatment, saying, do you think we're fools? Do you think we can't protect ourselves? Do you think I'd walk down these steps if I couldn't take care of myself? And by the time she finished with him, it was nothing but yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. And he was so terrified of her that you can't, and even though she, you know, was apparently a nice, ordinary lady, he was so terrified of ever upsetting her, even though he was so assigned to guard her, that...
Speak up, Charles.
He was so terrified of ever upsetting her that I just don't have words to describe it. And he thought that I was the bravest person in the world just to be willing to stand in the same room as that lady and talk with her, even though he was the guard that was assigned to protect her.
You had mentioned that they had they met a ward with the Greys, for example. How many different species do you think of extraterrestrials there might be out there?
Well, in my books, you'll see I describe, I've personally met two, the tall whites on which the books are based. But in book three, I describe the Norwegians, what I call the Norwegians with 24 teeth, that I've personally met. And I believe they come from, I know they come from one of the nearby stars, the either Bernard's star or the next star out, LAST. I know they come from a brown dwarf star. And the ones I describe as the Norwegians with 24 teeth are so much like us that if my dentist hadn't first shown me the x-rays of the guy's teeth, I would have never figured out that he wasn't human. And that was in Madison, Wisconsin in the fall of 1962. So I'm personally certain of two. And I know that I've never met a little gray, but I know that Roswell was the little grays crashing their craft. So that's three. I note that a study done in 1949 by the U.S. Army of the medic, which wasn't classified at the time, of the medical records at Auschwitz, asked the question, if you took the position that some human defects weren't humans but were extraterrestrials, how many extraterrestrials died in Auschwitz? And in the 1949 study published in the spring in a book that I used to read when I was a kid, when I was young, it concluded that there were 9 different kinds of extraterrestrials put to death in the Nazi prison camp and death chambers. The largest group was people with 24 teeth that were found in southern Norway and northern Europe and Denmark. There were like 5,562 of them or something, and which matches directly, and I'm certain that what I call the Norwegians with 24 teeth is that group, because one of the ones that I was talking to said that his mother's father had been put to death in the camps, and that when his parents arrived with him and his mother discovered that her father was dead, she was extremely distraught and upset, and it took her like a long time to get over it. And so if you count those, you know, I would conclude if it were me, I would put the number at 11 or 12.
At least. Paula, what would you say if you met one of the tall whites?
Well, first of all, I don't think I could say anything. I mean, I would have the same reaction of terror and panic that Charles had. I mean, it was a long time before he communicated with these people. I think that one thing I would do, though, George, is have the respect for the fact that they are different from me and not do anything that would be, you know, any reaction. I would like to act instead of react. In fact, I just wrote about this. If we could get used to this idea, then we wouldn't react and we wouldn't go crazy and we wouldn't resemble, as Charles said, the gorilla. We would be respectful, stand still, try to figure out what to do, and we need to know this, because I think that if this is the case, if this is really the case, some of these people are walking around.
Well, that may be. And it may be, Charles, where they may not look human, but would we look twice at them? I mean, do they fit in that closely?
If when throughout most of their adult life, especially the young women, are equivalent to, say, humans 19, 20, 21, it is possible for them to dress up to look human, so human, that if you saw them on the streets of Las Vegas, you would just think that they were like one of the showgirls.
Yeah, or some. Yeah, exactly.
And when I asked the teacher how I should react when they came, the teacher herself said that what they wanted was for us to enjoy being around them while they were here, as opposed to, you know, always picking or, you know, asking questions or pursuing. And so, because when they came for the fun of it. You know, I mean, they were stationed up at the base, and when they came in around, like in Las Vegas, when they went into the city or when they came in around humans, it's because they were bored and they wanted to have a good time.
That's an amazing story. Let's go back to the phones, Charles. First-time caller line, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, George.
Yes, sir.
Hey, this is Randy calling from Nashville.
Go for it, Randy.
Just wanted to first say I'm not an evolution believer, but as that is the accepted theory commonly, why would all of these aliens from other planets, virtually every common story you hear, the grays and the whites, why do they share similar features such as eyes, heads, you know, body structure, they stand upright and everything, and, you know, they can hear. Why would they have all the same senses and, you know, be that similar to us if they're on some other evolutionary scale, if evolution was true?
Well, the part of the seed, I would guess, Charles, is the same everywhere, isn't it?
Well, consider that space really isn't anywhere near as big as what we're led to believe. From the point of view of geological time, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. And consider, for example, the meteor crater in Arizona, which I guess geologists say hit, I don't know, 10 million years ago or something. Well, the explosion that would have generated would have been a steam explosion, not a volcanic explosion, and therefore it would have blasted huge quantities of genetic material, not just off the Earth, but out of the solar system, and that blast, being a steam blast, would not have heated the material high enough to destroy the DNA. And the velocities that blast would have, those particles would have been propelled out at velocities greater than American spacecraft achieved. And that means that in just a few years, like 10,000 or 70,000 years, all that material blasted off the Earth would be falling on planets around nearby stars. And that's just in a few thousand years, with 4.5 billion years to work from, and with meteors hitting not just all the planets in our solar system, Mars, the Moon, and so on, but hitting all the planets in other solar systems, you have a mechanism there for scattering DNA material all over the stars on this side of the galaxy. So it wouldn't be a surprise if you found strawberry plants here on Earth that looked just like equivalent strawberry plants on another planet, perhaps modified a little bit by evolution, but, you know, the same way that the plants in Australia are in many ways similar to the plants in, say, Africa. Because there's from the point of view of geological time and the amount of time spent that goes by in evolution, well, gee, just the natural processes could be scattering DNA material all over the place. If you, many viruses or many of those, many of those simpler organisms, like, you know, that carry DNA, they can be quick frozen, you know, like the blast would throw them out into space where they'd be quick frozen. And then if they fall into a warm ocean on a Earth-like planet on some distant star, they'll just start up again. You know, that doesn't kill the DNA at all.
All right. East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on with us. Hi there.
Hi. My name's Tom. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Hi, Tom. Go ahead. Snowy New Jersey, no doubt, huh?
Yes, sir. I have a question for Charles.
Sure.
I was curious if these beings ran into any other races like ours, like human race, anywhere else, and if they had any mammals or anything similar to dogs or anything like that, where they come from?
I believe I understood your question. You have such a soft voice that I maybe didn't hear quite all the words. But when I talked with the teacher, on the one, she was like any human mother. She was concerned that her daughter, which was her only child, that her daughter would grow up with friends who were little girls like her, and that she would get used to being a little girl. And so she used to like to have her daughter play with the human little girl, just so that it was two little girls playing together. And that implied that they had many of the same emotional reactions that we do. On the other hand, the tall whites themselves did not keep pets or had no interest in keeping pets. They were plant eaters. Some of my friends reported seeing them collect plant seeds and stuff up in the mountains, but they didn't go around collecting animals. Now, when I talked with the teacher, she said that their experience with other inhabited planets was that from their point of view, the Earth was unique, in that we keep animals, that we are the intelligent species, but we try to think like a horse, think like a cow. Her example was that I grew up in a farm in Wisconsin. I know how to milk cows and how to ride horses, and of course she pointed out that all those animals, and I make friends with dogs, they're nice pets, And she pointed out that all those animals could kill me anytime they wanted to, but that doesn't bother me because I've learned to think like they do. And so our bond between animals is much stronger than what you see on other planets, according to the teacher.
Paula, as we wrap up, and Charles, too, we may be able to squeeze a call in or two. I'm not sure how quickly we can. But, Paula, your book, Connecting the Dots, how do you get that?
Well, you can get it on Amazon.com for a very short time. You get it on my website, and you can get it from Fifth World Publishing. I wanted to add one thing really quickly, George. These are not the only alien races that are like us. I did some research on the Billy Meyer case and the Pleiadians, and so far there are many races that are like us, including the Native Americans believe that their ancestors came from the stars. So you have to look at the entire history of ufology, the entire history, to understand that this may be only one race that is out there.
And Charles, Millennial Hospitality Suites, how do you find it?
You can get it from Amazon.com or from links on Paula's website or from links on my website. My website is https://members.lycos.co.uk/Charles_Hall. Or if you do a search for Millennial Hospitality, it'll bring them up. But it's available, like Paula's book, it's available at bookstores anywhere in the world.
Well, I got to tell you, fascinating story indeed. Paula, thank you for being on the program.
Well,
Charles, thank you as well.
Uh-huh. Thanks.
All right, you take care of yourself. I mean, it's an incredible story, absolutely, that they're out there at Nellis Air Force Base, and also just hidden away, just simply hidden away in the mountains. Makes you wonder, doesn't it? For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.